Chapter 35, The Renaissance, A New Way of Thinking. Do you remember the magic carpet that you imagined in the very first chapter of this book? That magic carpet took you back in time to the days of the Roman Empire. We call those long-ago days ancient times. In ancient times, great empires, Assyria and Babylon, Egypt and Greece, spread over vast expanses of the world. The last great ancient empire, Rome, was the largest of all. Wide paved Roman roads ran all through this huge empire. Traders, soldiers, and ordinary people could travel from one end of the empire to the other. All of the people who lived within its borders followed the same laws. Most spoke the same language. When barbarians invaded Rome, the last great empire began to fall apart. Cities were destroyed. Roads became dangerous. People no longer traveled to distant places or learned the language that had once united the old fallen empire. They lived in separate villages, speaking their different languages. And they no longer read the old books written in Latin and Greek. They spent their days trying to grow enough food to stay alive and worrying about the next barbarian attack. For hundreds of years after the fall of Rome, the history of Europe seemed to follow the same pattern. A great warrior, ruler of a small kingdom, would lead his army against the other small kingdoms around him. He would conquer them and unite them all into a larger empire. His descendants would rule this empire for a little while, and then the empire would fall apart into small kingdoms again. Then another great warrior would start to gather an army, and the pattern would repeat itself. As these empires rose and fell, Christianity and Islam struggled with each other. We call the centuries after Rome was destroyed the Middle Ages. But around the time that Martin Luther and Christopher Columbus lived, 1,000 years after the fall of Rome, the pattern that had gone on for hundreds of years started to change. Countries such as England, France, Spain, and Italy managed to build strong armies that protected them from invasion for years at a time. The people who lived in these countries didn't have to worry constantly about barbarian invasion. They had time to think, read and study, instead of looking for a place to hide from the next rampaging army. What did they read? Well, when the Ottoman Turks conquered the city of Constantinople and turned its great cathedral into a Muslim mosque, hundreds of Eastern Orthodox Christian scholars left the city and traveled west into Europe. They brought with them scrolls written in Greek. Some of these scrolls were copies of books of the Bible. Others were writings of great Christians who had lived hundreds of years before. The Eastern Orthodox Church had kept these manuscripts safe for centuries. When the Eastern Orthodox scholars settled down in Europe, they taught others to read these Greek writings. Slowly, men and women who enjoyed reading and study began to be interested again in the old Greek and Latin books that had been ignored for hundreds of years. Many of these writings were translated into the languages of Spain, Italy, England, and France. More and more people began to hear about the ideas, the art, and the history of ancient Greece and Rome. Artists began to try to make their sculptures and paintings look like Greek art, which was realistic, more like a photograph. Sculptures began to look more and more like real people with real muscles and skin. Painters tried to make their landscapes look like real landscapes, and the light in their paintings looked like it was really shining from the sun. Builders designed their buildings with Greek columns and Roman arches. Scientists studied Greek and Roman explanations for the movements of the stars and planets. Philosophers thought about Greek ideas. We call this time the Renaissance. Renaissance means rebirth. In a way, Greek and Roman ideas died during the Middle Ages because so few people could read Greek and Latin books. Then, during the Renaissance, Greek and Latin ideas were reborn as these books were read again. But the Renaissance wasn't just a time when people relearned old ideas. It was also a time of new discoveries. For the first time, ships were sailing all over the world. Explorers were realizing that their old ideas about the world, like boiling seas in the south and water that poured forever off the edge of the world, were wrong. So during the Renaissance, men and women began to make new theories about the world. They compared their new theories with the old Greek and Roman ideas. They started to ask, which ideas about the world are right? Let's go try to find out for ourselves. When Prince Henry the Navigator sent ships south to see the southern waters, rather than just accepting the old stories about boiling seas, he was thinking like a Renaissance man. When Columbus insisted on going to India by sailing west, instead of trying to go around Africa like everyone else, he was acting like a Renaissance man. When Martin Luther told the people of Wittenberg that they should look at the Bible for themselves, instead of believing everything that the church told them, he was talking like a Renaissance man. During the Renaissance, men and women began to believe that they could find out truth by looking at the world and figuring out how it worked. After all, they argued, God had created the world. Why couldn't man, who was also created by God, look carefully at this world and understand it? So they observed the world, the sky, the earth around them, the people who lived on the earth. They drew conclusions from what they observed. Today we call this the scientific method of getting knowledge. When you observe something and try to draw conclusions from your observations, you are thinking scientifically. This way of thinking had its roots in the Renaissance. Gutenberg's great invention. Think about the Middle Ages. Knights in armor, horseback, stone castles, food cooked over open fires, long journeys on horseback, silk and spices from India. Now think about the world today. Cars, airplanes, telephones, computers, Legos, movies. What invention did the most to change the world? The answer might surprise you. The printing press. Without printed books, the Renaissance might never have happened, and our modern world would look very different. Before the printing press was invented, books were written by hand. Do you remember learning about the medieval monks who copied out manuscripts in their monasteries? They had to make paper called parchment out of animal skins. They had to mix up ink, sharpen a feather into a pen, and write out each letter of each book. One book might take years to finish. When it was done, it was put in the monastery library and chained to the shelf so that no one could take it away. Only kings and very rich men could afford to have books in their homes. There were no picture books, no magazines, no newspapers, no printed instructions or directions. During the Middle Ages, merchants trading with China learned how to make paper from the Chinese. This paper was made by soaking bark, straw, or old rags in water, pressing it into sheets, and drying it. Paper was much easier and quicker to make than animal skin parchment. Now these merchants could keep records of how many pieces of silk or pottery they had sold. But they still had to write all of their facts and figures by hand. There were still no books. Imagine for a moment that you live in a world without printed books, instructions, or directions. You want to play a new board game that came with 5 different sets of playing pieces, a spinner, 2 dice, 1 black and 1 yellow, and a funny metal chain with triangular links. And there are no instructions. How will you figure out what to do with all of those game parts? Eventually, you might figure out how to play a game with the board and the parts, but your rules probably won't be like anyone else's. If you visit friends who have the same game, you won't be able to play with them until they explain all their rules. Pretend that you're a scientist who wants to study the stars, but you don't know what other scientists have already discovered about the stars because you don't have any science books. All you have are your eyes and the sky. After years and years of study, you figure out some basic facts about the stars, but it takes you so long to learn these simple facts that you never discover much more. All over the world, other scientists do exactly the same thing. So no one gets very far in his study of the stars. If only all of you had books. Then you could each learn the basic facts in just a few months of study. Suppose that you are a Christian who wants to find out what the Bible says about right and wrong, but you don't have a Bible. There's a huge Bible chained to the pulpit of your church in your village, but it's written in a language you can't read. So you ask your priest what the Bible says. He doesn't read very well either, so he tells you what his priest told him years ago when he asked the same question. He might be right, or he might be wrong. That's what life was like in Europe during the Middle Ages. Because there were so few books, scientists didn't make very many new discoveries. Historians couldn't find out much about the past. Doctors knew very little about the human body, and Christians had to find out what the Bible said by asking their priests. They had to trust their priest to give them the right information. Then everything changed. A young man in Germany, the country of Martin Luther, was learning how to be a goldsmith. His name was Johannes Gutenberg. As he melted his gold and silver and poured the metal into molds, Johannes Gutenberg began to wonder whether he could also mold letters out of metal. He thought to himself, "I could fit the letters together to form a metal page. Then I could dip this metal page down into ink and press it onto paper. I could make hundreds of paper copies in no time at all. And then I could rearrange the letters to make another page." Gutenberg experimented with finding just the right kind of metal for his pages. It had to be soft enough to press down on a page without shattering, but hard enough to stay in shape. He had to make molds for each letter, pour the letters in, wait for them to cool, and then remove them. His ink had to be just the right thickness, thick enough to cling to the metal when he dipped it in, but thin enough to come off the metal onto the paper. He had to find a way to lift the metal page up and press it down over and over on sheet after sheet of paper. After years of experimenting, Gutenberg made a printing press from an old wine press that had been used to squeeze grapes. He made metal letters out of mixtures of tin, lead, and a poisonous metal called antimony. He made a new kind of ink with oil in it, and he began to work on his great project, a Bible. It took him several years to set all the metal letters into place for the pages, but once the pages were set, Gutenberg and 20 helpers printed 450 Bibles in 1 year. If 20 monks had tried to write out these Bibles by hand, it would have taken them 90 years each. Others borrowed Gutenberg's technique. An English merchant named William Caxton got interested not just in printing books, but in translating them into the languages that people could actually read. He printed books of history and poetry in English. He also printed a book about how to play chess, the first printed set of directions. As time went on, more and more books were printed. Books became cheaper and cheaper. More and more people could buy and read them. Now, ordinary, everyday men and women could read about the past glories of Greece and Rome. Explorers could find out what other explorers had discovered in their journeys. Scientists could read what other scientists were learning and doing in other countries. And Christians could read their own Bibles, written in their own languages.